Speaking of Reliability, a podcast with good friends talking with you about reliability engineering topics.
Welcome to Speaking of Reliability. This is Kirk Gray.
And this is Fred Schenkelberg. Hey, Kirk.
Hey, Fred.
You know, you talk about you got to test the failure all the time, right? You have to have failures.
You have to test to a limit. Yes, you have to test to a limit. It may not be a catastrophic destruction of your product. And in fact, I wouldn't go beyond operating limit in most cases, in only special cases where I'd go beyond where you can't see it operate.
Right. Well, you've often said, though, that a failure of any kind is gold, whether it's in the field or a prototype or whatever. Right. That's when you actually can learn something.
That's right.
Now, here's the dilemma is, and it comes from, I got a sneak peek at this database that Karina is putting together, and I'm drawing a complete blank on her last name, so I apologize, but she's in the maintenance, like factory maintenance type world, and so, and she showed me one setup for, I think it was a gearbox of some sort, and it was focused in the example I saw was focusing on just gears, right?
A
gear of some sort.
A gear that has a wear out mechanism, yes.
Well, it doesn't have just one. It has many.
Very, very many.
But if you, so she said, you know, she pulled up a screen and it had like the four most common failure mechanisms. And one of them was a bending force on the tooth that creates a crack and then eventually it falls off. Another one was it's wearing at the top of it is wearing. You're getting these metal filings everywhere, kind of the different signatures, the way she called it. And it's a good term for it is one, you can see a crack. The other one, you see, this wear pattern. And then she went on a couple other mechanisms. And then what was cool about it is then it said, oh, and here's once you see this and at different stages, she had it broken down by this is very early indicator that this is happening. And if you don't treat it, it's going to look like this. And if you don't replace it, it's going to look like this. And eventually it's just going to fall apart. You know, here's the type of symptoms you're going to get. And so I thought, yeah, this is really cool because immediately for me, it said, oh, here's four ways that this tooth can fail on one screen with pictures and I thought it was pretty slick.
And there are different factors that
cause those
will impact that, temperature cycling.
It could be thermal
the lubricant.
It could be lubricant failing. It could be misalignment. It could be design improperly. All kinds of stuff.
Imbalance, all kinds of things,
It go into it. And I was but usually when we're doing failure analysis, it's we look at it. And if you're not familiar with the wear pattern, say on the edge of a tooth, that's not normal. If you don't know what normal looks like, every tooth you ever took apart, every gearbox you took apart, it always had some wear pattern in it. You would think it's that's the way it's supposed to look. And so part of it, and I ran into this a handful of times by experience where, you know, like white powder on a circuit board, yeah, I'm sure you've run into like there's white the board failed, there's white powder on the like, well, what is the white powder? And oh, so your hands contain different like chlorine and other ion, you know, ionic type chemicals that can cause metals to move and cause short circuits and stuff like that. And but until I ran into one of those and started asking around, I had no idea what it was. And so then I became very suspicious of white powder and said, well, the first step is go do this, figure out what is this white powder and is it benign or not? And where did it come from? Stuff like that. But we do that all the time. It's, I mean, I remember the story. And I got to find that episode and link to it. Is that you were over the shoulder of some poor electrician diagnosing some circuit breaker in your house and or whatever it was, and or your furnace or some system. But you could see that's the problem. And he goes, okay, I'm replacing the whole board.
Well, I don't recall that, but you know, it's the fact that you have to know something about failure mechanisms. And the way you do that is you have to actually look at actual product that's come back from the field or failed.
Well, what's a better way to do that? How do you, because we all don't have 30 years to get experience with all the failure mechanisms the hard way.
No, we don't have 30 years. And certainly, but if you're in a company, you can look at a lot of the failure. If it's been doing failure analysis, you can certainly look into that. And it's, and they're all very specific to your industry, whatever it is. If you're making pumps and motors, then the wear mechanisms and monitoring those wear mechanisms, and there are many different ways. You could measure the density of the oil or the lubricants, or you could look at the content of metal in the lubricant, or there's just it's kind of going along.
This is all coming from experience here, Kirk. This is all coming from your experience and knowing.
It's coming from my experience, right?
Yeah,
but also knowing material science and physics.
Yeah, you have to understand some of the basics of it. And for me, it's always been what I like about doing failure analysis. It is an opportunity to go learn something, and always approach it with, well, that doesn't look quite right. And then I changed it to, why does it look that way?
Right.
Why is it behaving that way? And then we go into more complicated, like fishbone diagrams and stuff, and brainstorm what could be happening. Mm-hmm. And I've also seen databases with like FMEAs where they say, oh, if you have a capacitor, it could fail short, it could fail open, or it could be intermittent. And I says, well, that's not useful at all. No. Come on, tell me something useful here. Those are symptoms of an underlying problem.
Right.
What is the mechanism? Why is it open or short or intermittent? How in the world do you get it intermittent on a capacitor? You know, it's probably a where it's solder is cracked all the way through and it's bouncing up and down with temperature. Yeah.
Definitely capacitors are one of the hardest things to diagnose and open. Except for a short, you can do it with
shorts
a short.
Are easy because it's just,
it's always open.
it behaves like it's open, but if it's supposed to give you a capacitance value there, some circuits then just don't work.
Right.
Even though it looks like it's fine, but you take it apart and you say, oh, okay, this lead came apart. This, the foil is whatever. There's ways to do it, but you have to know what you're looking for. And we're a really good failure analysis lab, the technicians and the engineers that work at really good labs, they remind me of the old mechanic that could lean up against a Jeep in the army and go, oh, your timing's off. They could just feel it.
Right.
In the vibration.
And that came from experience.
Yeah.
That came from looking at and knowing in the past. And I think this is where AI is really going to help us. I mean, it can look through thousands of records of the field data and then show rates of failure, especially for things the problem like with that analysis is you're talking about variabilities of end use conditions that may have caused the failure and wear out
and just different ways we describe stuff.
But when we talk about the electrolyte in the aluminum electrolytic capacitors, getting a wrong formula, somebody starting and having a manufacturing excursion, as we would call it, where they manufactured and didn't know it, nobody counted on the electrolyte being mismanufactured.
Well, yeah, we often trust our vendors and suppliers and our own manufacturing to get it right. We don't have time to double check we never be able to sell a product. But the idea is that when you're doing failure analysis at any stage, I contend that there's, you talked about the chemistry, physics, how could this occur?
What drives that? What is driving this? What are the inputs? What are the, like you say, maybe just putting it together. What are the things, what are you listing the different parametrics that cause it? to happen.
Now, if you ask a college grad coming into, you know, reliability engineering, they may or may not have taken a class on failure mechanisms. They may or may not be familiar with electronics at all. They might have been in a mechanical system.
Right? I don't know where there's a class on failure mechanisms.
There's one at Maryland. It's actually really horrible, by the way. I've heard it from many students that it was a painful process. This is, it was not a good course. And the professor, you know, didn't
care. Okay, where's a good failure?
I don't know. Course, right? That's the only one I've heard of.
That's what I, because I, you know, they have to dig from people's, the real, okay, there's.
But anyway, that's so like the, talk, okay, but let's say you get a new mechanical engineer joins your team and they're going to be working on a circuit board. My question to them is, how many ways can corrosion occur on a circuit board? And if they get a blank stare, is that you need to go learn it, because there's galvanic corrosion, there's, you know, oxidation type corrosion, there's, you know, this and this and this and this. There's like a dozen different electromigration stuff. You know, on and on and on. I'm drawing a blank here as I'm trying.
And then you work on a 200 kilovolt linear particle accelerator. And you find out that, you know, the absolute 999.99999 purity water that has to run so that between the source,
like a dielectric,
where the plasma source was, and has to be an absolute pure 15 mega ohm, you know, water resistance. If you have a leak and it goes on a circuit board, guess what? You're going to have etching on the traces. Why? Because absolutely pure water has a certain pH that's not quite neutral. I think it actually is acidic, slightly acidic. So it would actually attack the metal ions. Right. And, you know, that was... Nobody would know that. Who uses absolute 15 mega
well, water? Well, I've seen people use really pure silver and on a board and say it's got great electrical properties. Yeah, it also draws its own circuitry. It'll go wherever there's an electric magnetic field, it's going to follow it independently of where you put it on the board.
Well,
or really, really pure tin.
Right, we've got tin whiskers. That's been
Not tin whiskers, but tin pest. You ever hear of that one?
Tin what?
Pest, P-E-S-T.
P-E-S-T, yeah. No.
So very pure tin. And I don't know if it had to be under current or under some kind of load. It just turns to powder. You might form it in like some metallic shape, but it with oxygen, it just turns to powder.
Oh, it oxidizes.
Yeah.
It oxidizes. Okay.
Yeah. But
Well, you wouldn't use iron as a conductor either.
Well, people have. They have for a long, long time. But the idea is I think there's a, if you're not inherently curious, you know, like I took my mom's toaster apart and then she wanted me to put it back together, which I never did. So I learned a lot about failure mechanisms trying to put it back together.
Right.
But the idea is that it would be cool to have a workshop where you have a bunch of stuff and it's tossed away, or, you know, there's the maker fairs where you can bring an old toaster that's not working, or coffee pot, or whatever device it is. And they have a whole bunch of people there that will diagnose it and say, oh, here, fix this, or resolder a wire, or do stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
But they get great experience going after one product after another and just doing quick analysis and repairs.
Right.
And
right.
But it's how do you create awareness of if you didn't know about galvanic corrosion. And I saw this just the other day. They were putting two very dissimilar metals together. And I'm like, you know, I got a little chart that talks about if you put copper with iron or something like that, they're really different. And they cause, just by being in contact with each other, will corrode. And they went, what? How's that? Yeah, here it is.
Isn't that how you make a thermocouple too?
kind of thing. It's like
two different metals, you know, have that interaction. Yeah, well, Fred, it's just the variety of industries that, you know, and the different, I mean, if you were in the downhole measurement industry for oil wells,
yeah,
that, you know, you're talking about a whole different world of a above 150 degrees C type
failures.
Well,
in space, you know, there's no gravity, so heat does not rise. So you, you got to deal with heat a different way.
Right. But I guess so, you know, and if you're dealing with, you know, biomedical equipment, it's just, there's of course a lot of similarity with the failure mechanisms that occur on a PCB, a printed wiring circuit board assembly. And they, in fact, pulling out any PCB from a system won't, they all look they look pretty much the same. A power supply looks pretty much the same. So yeah, there's very common, you know, failure mechanisms like component adjacency, touching, you know, it's kind of those kind of things, but they're all unique in some ways to what the, how the product's been designed and, its environmental conditions and just a lot of things. So, and also manufacturing excursions, like we talked about, that
always
are not
stuff.
Those are not expected, they're not
be.
Really okay. What if, you know, all these component manufacturers? What if their epoxy was the wrong had the wrong thermal coefficient of expansion for their encapsulant?
It would just rip apart whatever's in it.
Yeah. Right, exactly. Yeah. And that's not expected.
I ran into one on epoxy. I think you were at Dell at the time as at HP, is that it was the black epoxy that we commonly use over electronics, right?
Right.
It has carbon black in it.
And
it's meant to be, and there's a flame retardant material in there that they have different techniques. And I don't know what was commonly used, but some of them create water. Some of the flame retardants, you know, kind of explode and blow out the flame. There's a bunch of different techniques for flame retardant stuff, but there's like 20 to 30% of that epoxy blend is this flame retardant stuff. And it's the one that I ran into was, it was pretty corrosive. So that if that particle got separated from the epoxy and it landed, and you know, they would land right on the leads of the primary, you know, signal lead or something like that, timing lead, it'll corrode it and cause it to corrode open or short with the next system. Okay. And we discovered it because our disk drives were failing. And you start taking it apart, and you're seeing this weird corrosion that the chemist guy said, well, this comes from the flame retardant in the epoxy. I'm like, what? And it turns out that the component manufacturer, the ones that package it, bought the epoxy, and the epoxy folks bought the flame retardant from somebody. And this is when we're off.
Yeah, it's a long chain. Right, it's a long chain.
And we would, and they changed the mesh of sifting this material so that it was a little bit bigger. And they got more yield that way. So they were happy. And they said, that won't affect anybody. But if you add a little bit of vibration, and some of that epoxy's grains will be near the edge, they vibrated free.
All right.
Whereas the smaller ones didn't. And they stayed captured. And, it happened in hard drives first, but then we start, you know, it eventually would happen in any component. And that's when the lawyers got involved, and we never saw any more about it. But we did the failure analysis and said, well, that's odd. Why is that happening?
Right. Why is that happening? And these are kind of things, the fact that you're not, that's kind of a not a common cause, but a special cause failure that the manufacturer, one of the people in the chain of material suppliers was not, you know, aware of the impact of to the others. And epoxies, encapsulant epoxies are, of course, very highly protected secrets. They're usually proprietary because of the nature of getting the right mix for the correct TCE. You talked about fire retardant and other things that have to go into it.
Well, it has to seal, too.
It has to seal, right.
It has to actually bond seal with the component so it doesn't have contamination.
It has to go through a reflow of 185C to 200C and not melt and not be damaged and expand and contract every time the power is turned on to the device at the same rate, but also underfill for BDAs is a problem too. Yep. That's been mismatched where the TCEs where it was not expanding, contracting, and eventually sheared some of the balls. So, you know, there's just, of course, there'd be, there's thousands of failure mechanisms or potential failure mechanisms in any circuit board, in any one of those tiers of suppliers, in their chains of material suppliers in that. You know, I don't know if the Nichicon bought their electrolytic formula from somebody else and then put it into their, or they developed it internally and just somebody messed up.
I heard was the guy that was blending the electrolytic solution took vacation, and somebody else came in and wasn't aware that you're supposed to add this white powder until it turns a particular color, because they didn't have weights or anything else. The guy was just scooping it out of a barrel and pouring it in, stirring it until it was the right color.
Real precision there. Yep.
It was. It was close enough that it worked.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it worked for years.
When he wasn't there, somebody said, well, how much are you supposed to put in? Well, put in enough. And like when the chef tells you to add salt to taste, and like, well, whose taste?
Yeah. Just tell the guy the formula, you know, don't write it down or, you know, have any precision measurements to it.
Well, there's a lot of processes like that.
I know. And they work fine until somebody screws up.
Goes on vacation.
Vacation, right. And that happens all the time. So that's the thing. I say to list all those failure mechanisms in a book, in a class.
In a course or whatever.
You just said one that you knew was terrible. So I kind of don't know. We'd have to piece that apart. Why was it terrible and what were they doing? Because you can talk about electromigration. You can talk about
tin
whisters, cracked solder joints, the delamination. The many things could happen just on a circuit board, much less motors, pumps, mechanical systems. It's kind of like if you were to try and learn all those things, that could take years. And when you get into a company, a lot of those things are irrelevant because they're not dealing with those mechanisms, like, you know, pneumatic pistons closing a polyvinyl tube to stop a flow.
If you're not using that, you don't need.
You're not using it. So to broadly go and try and learn all the failure mechanisms to me would be admirable, but unless you're teaching a college course or some general course.
And even then you're still going to just scratch the surface. Yet I think there's two parts to it. One is be aware that things fail in different ways. And here's at some level, just understanding what corrosion is and how's that different than wear, you know, is the baseline. You got to start somewhere. And then there's interesting ones that give you clear signals that you can measure, like the one that database is talking about. You can measure metals in your lubricant, and that metal's got to come from someplace. It's not coming from the lubricant. So
I think, and these are all the things that could lead to better prognostics and health monitoring, which is a big relatively new approach to monitoring and for products and components that wear out, like IGBTs, right?
IGBTs.
They're a power device used in a lot of course, wind generators and
inverters. Well, anything from AC to DC.
Right.
DC to AC.
So those have wear out mechanisms, and they do fail before the product's technological obsolescence because of, you know, solar panels and wind generators are supposed to last, 20 years? Something like that. So they know this, and that's, there's getting more work in predicting the known wear out failure mechanisms.
But then somebody goes out and takes a shotgun and shoots them up, and then they're like, we didn't expect that failure mechanism.
Right. And I know that those guys out there in the world of failure analysis said, wow, when they've opened up a case of something, it's a wow. You know, how did that
rat get in there?
We thought we had a small enough grill that it wouldn't be able to crawl through. But yeah, those are the kind of things you just those are kind of learned from experience, you know, and it's very, many times very product specific.
Oh, I'm sure it is. But I'm thinking there's got to be a way to help folks come up the speed quicker. And so we'll talk again about it someday.
But okay.
I've got a few ideas. And this database I saw, at least for the, you know, factory equipment type stuff, look pretty slick. I really like it. So hopefully we get more folks to get a chance to check that out.
Yeah. It's great to see anything about, you know, giving you a starter for
so at least anybody, what to look at. Let's ask our audience, though, if you're listening to this and have some ideas of, you know, how do you come up to speed quicker on identifying failure mechanisms so that you know what the next steps are to deal with it. I'm all ears. And I think, Kirk, you'd be interested in it, too, because it's it. Or even better is if you have a really cool failure mechanism you've learned. We'd love to hear the story of it.
Right. And tell me one that's not expected and really surprised you, and you've never seen it before.
Yeah. And as you know, there's always a story, and we don't have to name names or industries or whatever, but enough details so we get an idea with the mechanism. That'd be wonderful. Right. So anyway, you can get a hold of us at ascendoreliability.com/go/SOR. And you can also get a hold of Kirk or I and the other hosts of the show through LinkedIn or our About pages. So there's plenty of ways to get in touch. And hopefully one of those three or four different paths will work. So although this morning I was checking out failure mechanisms on an email system, and that's a whole different world. We didn't even talk about software.
Yeah, exactly. there's another one that, you know, another input another that can fail. It can cause can a, fail. Yeah, 2,000 ways it can fail. So
yeah. Why does anything work? That's the real mystery for me.
Well, it is. It's amazing that it does work. And when my wife gets mad at something failing technologically, I say, but you really enjoyed it when it was working, and it was really helpful to you when it was working. And you're glad that the engineers made that and designed that for you most of the time. Now that you become dependent on it, you're really mad.
That's right. So you know you got a good product when that happens. But anyway, yeah. So good talking to you, Kirk.
Yeah, we'll talk again soon.
Yeah, cheers.
Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation if you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show. Please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.